The holiday from history is over, and a new age of great power competition has begun. With war raging in Europe and the Middle East, and with tensions rising throughout Asia, the heady days of optimism that followed the end of the Cold War now feel very far away indeed. But who are the great powers? What do they want? And how will they shape the future of geopolitics? These questions lie at the heart of a new book, The Return of the Great Powers, by the historian Brendan Sims. Brendan is the Professor of the History of International Relations at the University of Cambridge, and I'm delighted to say that he joins me in the studio today. Brendan, welcome to the EI podcast.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Looking at the world today, it can seem perhaps self-evident that great power competition has returned and that geopolitical rivalry is very much back in play, whether we look at the tariff wars between Trump's America and Xi's China or the conflict in Ukraine. Why did you decide to write this book at this exact moment in time, and what were you trying to achieve by doing so?
I think you're absolutely right to say that the prevalence of great power politics is now self-evident. When I started writing the book several years ago, that wasn't so obvious. And what I was really trying to argue was that the holiday from history that you alluded to earlier, which in a sense began with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, that holiday from history was over, and in fact had really been over at the latest since 2014 with the illegal Russian annexation of the Crimea and, of course, the start of the conflict in eastern Ukraine. So added to which, of course, there was the confrontation between the US and the People's Republic of China over East Asia, and in particular over the status of Taiwan. So those are the principal issues that I had in mind when writing the book.
And why did this notion of the end of history or a holiday from history prove to be so powerful in the minds of Western statesmen and policymakers for so long?
I think there were a number of reasons, but the principal one was that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a loss of an element of international balance. And when I say balance, I don't mean that in a positive sense or a negative sense necessarily, but simply in noting the fact that whereas you had a countervailing force to the United States and the West prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, that was no longer the case. So that essentially people argued either that we were now in an era of multipolarity, where the United States was simply all dominant, or that in a sense we had left behind, we'd almost transcended the very notion of great powerness, that was something that was irrelevant, that we were now in an age of globalization, of transnational connection. And you see the tenacity of that way of thinking, for example, in Chancellor Merkel of Germany's response to the annexation of Crimea, where she says that Putin really is not living in the 21st century. He's living in the 19th century. So that shows that in her mind, that great powerness, annexations, aggression was something that one had left behind and was not coming back.
And in the beginning of the book, you trace the evolution and growth of this great power system that really starts in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries, but later comes to encompass the whole world. If we look at things in the long durée, in the grand sweep of history, is there a sense in which actually the post-Cold War peace dividend was an aberration and we're returning to a greater continuity, we're returning to the historical norm?
I think that's right. I think the period, the 20-odd years after the end of the Cold War, were in many ways an interlude. And what is fascinating is that the main players today, certainly the United States and the People's Republic of China, of course also Russia, I would argue the UK, and even France, all these powers were powers which were important in the 20th century, but also in many cases going back hundreds of years. So in that sense, it's been a return to an existing system.
How would you characterize the geopolitical landscape today? You hinted at it when you said we're returning to an age of multipolarity, but there are also others who would say that actually it's bipolarity, but the two poles are essentially the United States and China. And in the book, you don't necessarily come down on one side or the other, but you suggest that actually the multipolarity model is more likely. Could you take us through that?
I think a lot will depend on how American politics go. So if the Trump tendency persists even after his departure from office, assuming, of course, he does depart from office, and depending on how he departs from office. But if that tendency persists, then I think you're right. Then I think we may be more in an age of multipolarity. On the other hand, if you have, say, a return to the Biden tendency, or even perhaps a Republican internationalist, then I think we would be back in what I describe in the book as a bi-order world. That was really the order up until November 2024 with the second election of Donald Trump, where you might have different actors, distinct actors, but broadly speaking, you had a Western order led by the United States, but with strong partners, and an Eastern authoritarian order in which featured prominently the People's Republic of China, the Russian Federation, Iran, North Korea, and then maybe a few odds and ends, like Belarus, on top of it. So that is really the question, which way it will go. I don't think we can talk simply about bipolarity in any case, because Russia would never accept the notion of a bipolarity in which it was not one of the poles, and India would not likewise.
I think that gets to the heart of the main theme of the book, which is the great powers themselves. You define certain attributes of great powerness, as you describe it. So how should we define a great power? What is it that constitutes this great powerness that you talk about?
I propose four criteria, the so-called four R's: resources, reach, reputation, and resilience. Resources is in many ways obvious. It is, do you have a large enough economy? So are you in the top one to, say, five or six largest economies in the world by GDP? Obviously, then you have to differentiate between nominal dollar GDP and purchasing power parity. That's an issue one could discuss. Does the state in question have a sufficiently large army or effective army? Does it have nuclear weapons, which I would say are a necessary condition, but not a sufficient one? Then you come to the question of reach, and that's really an issue around, is the state more than just locally dominant? So if you take, for example, a power like Turkey, which is really quite effective in its immediate neighborhood, perhaps in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Caucasus, the Middle East, perhaps the Black Sea, but doesn't really have any reach beyond there. Compare that to, say, the United Kingdom, which does have heavy lift capacity in terms of airlift, also what is still one of the most effective navies in the world, and the carrier strike group with all its limitations. Then you see the difference. So that is the question of reach. Central to that also is the question of bases. So the UK, for instance, has got bases in Cyprus, in Gibraltar, and in other places, which would not be true, for example, of Turkey, just to give an instance. Thirdly, the question of reputation. And that is made up really of two components. One is that power regarded as a major actor by other powers? But secondly, also, and this is a thought I drew from Leopold von Ranke, who wrote a famous essay on the great powers in 1833, does the power in question stand for something more than just brute force? Does it represent a principle in the world? So the United Kingdom, and at least until recently, the United States, represented the principles of democracy, of the rule of law, international law. Of course, you can criticize their performance in particular aspects, but broadly speaking, that is what they stood for and stand for. India, for example, regards itself as a kind of global teacher, the world guru, as some in India, including Modi, have put it. Russia would argue that it stands for the conservative principle, for Christianity, against essentially the decadence of the West. So that's reputation. And then lastly, resilience. And that's really the hardest thing of all to assess. But essentially, resilience is drawn from the historical experience. It is looking at the performance of a state over time. And if you do that, you see quite quickly that you've got countries like the United States and the UK, which for all the ruptures, and particularly in the US, of course, you have a civil war, essentially have an unbroken constitutional tradition, have never been occupied by a foreign power, or at least not since 1066, and have that real sense of being able to bounce back from adversity. If you think, for example, Britain's loss of the 13 colonies towards the end of the 18th century, it's a huge, huge blow, but within a small number of years, Britain had mastered the debt and was then starting to fight France in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. And then you've got other actors, like, for example, Russia, which have suffered catastrophic state failure on a number of occasions, 1917 with the Russian Revolution, of course, but then equally the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So you have a real sense of brittleness, and that needs to be taken into account. Also true, by the way, of Germany and Japan, which, of course, suffered catastrophic defeat in the Second World War. And I think also true to a certain extent for China or the PRC, which, of course, experienced such turbulence in the 20th century, and where, again, the durability of the regime is not entirely clear.
We'll get into the great powers that you identify in a moment. I just wanted to ask you one more question about great powerness and great power status. You make the compelling case that there are a variety of factors that you need to consider when assessing whether a country is a great power or not. You write that actually this is more of an art than a science. And it struck me reading the book that actually there's a subtle critique running through it of Paul Kennedy's The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, where he essentially asserts that it's the economic base that really matters. It's the economic structure and power of a country that then translates into its great power status and its ability to project power in the world. You've complicated that somewhat. Could you just explain why it's important to complicate that?
Yes. So Paul's book is a terrific book, to be clear. I wish I'd written it myself. And he makes a very, very important point, which is that economic capability is central to great powerness. So if you're completely broke, plainly you cannot be a great power. But as you suggest, I complicate the story quite significantly by insisting that, first of all, great powers are obviously range immensely in size. So historically, for example, in the 18th century, everybody knew that Prussia was the smallest, really, of the great powers. It was a great deal less significant than France or Britain, and yet everybody knew it was a great power. It was not economically anywhere near the top in the 18th century. China, let's say in the 1950s, is not in economic terms a major actor. Russia today is plainly a great power and regarded as such by many. It's not universally the case. I mean, Philip Sobrine, for example, makes a very strong argument for saying that Russia is not a great power, but most people accept that Russia is a great power. But if you look at the economics, Russia is well down. It's 8 or 9, perhaps, and in truth, probably even lower than that in many significant respects. So while the economy is important, it's not sufficient. And you've got many very strong economies, or a number of strong economies, like, say, Japan, and those of that of Germany, where in fact their great powerness is qualified for other reasons. So economics is not enough.
You talk a great deal actually in the book about capacity. So it's not just about having raw resources, as you say, it's about the capacity to mobilize them. And it's also about a power's capacity to mobilize others, whether that's through alliances, soft power, or ideological appeal. Could you just expand on that as well?
Yes. So this is really the interface between resources and reputation. So if you take Britain, for example, its capacity on the world stage, and particularly in Europe, during the classic periods of, you know, through the 18th century through to the mid-20th century, has been not just a question of its own resources, but the ability to draw on those of others, or to mobilize, as you say, those of others. And not just in material sense, but also in the cultural, ideological, psychological sense. And you see this very strongly in a famous memorandum by a senior Foreign Office official, Eric Crowe, at the start of the 20th century, which is mainly preoccupied with the German threat, German challenge, but he's quite confident about the fact that whatever difficulties other states may have with the UK, and almost everybody has some difficulty at that point with the UK, it just came with the territory, they generally speaking preferred the leadership of the UK to that of any other power. And so I think that is really where the value of the rules-based international order and international system lies, is that it's a kind of permissiveness within it that gives license to powers, particularly like the United States today, although that's now being qualified, but also some of the other Western actors like the United Kingdom to behave in the way they do.
Now, I think we've teased the audience enough. It's time to come to the four great powers that you identify in the book. And now there is a little teaser on the front cover of the book, on the dust jacket. And I've got it in my hand here. I'm going to hand it to you. There are four flags, two of which are rather pristine and two of which look a bit sad and dilapidated. Can you take us through your four great powers, Brendan?
That's right. So there are actually two covers. There's the US cover in which you've got four pristine flags, which I think is potentially a little bit misleading, because what I like about the cover on the UK edition is that as you indicated, you've got two pristine flags, but you also have two flags which are very visibly fraying at the edges. One of them is the UK Union flag, and the other, of course, is the flag of the Russian Federation. And what I'm trying to argue, therefore, is that we have four great powers by my criteria, two of which are unquestionably great powers: the United States, for reasons that hardly need elaboration; the People's Republic of China, on account of its incredible economic strength, but also increasingly its military heft. And then you've got two powers whose status is a little bit more contested: the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation. And as I said earlier, this is quite similar to the situation we've had in the past, where you've had great powers of differing sizes. So I'm by no means suggesting, to be clear, that Russia and the UK are of equal status to the US and the PRC. They're obviously not, but they're all great powers and shape the world in significant ways.
One thing that you're keen to emphasize is that actually great power status is a relative category in some senses, and we need to understand their relative strengths and weaknesses, as you just said. What are the relative strengths and weaknesses of the United States? Because this is really the benchmark great power. It's the greatest of the great powers, as you describe it. What are the US's strengths and weaknesses?
So I come to the United States right at the end of the book. And that's for a reason, which is that almost everybody will accept that the United States is a great power. And there's no great mystery about explaining why it's a great power, because in terms of military capacity, its capacity is huge. It has a massive army. It has all the technological support. It has a huge nuclear arsenal, second only to that of the Russian Federation. It is the largest economy in the world. So in terms of resources, very clear. In terms of reach, equally, the US basing system completely covers the globe. There's really no part of the world which is not reachable by the United States in some shape or form. As far as reputation is concerned, as I said, everybody considers it to be a great power, and it's stood for a long time for a particular version of Western democratic modernity. It now, under the Trump administration, seems to stand for something a bit different, perhaps a more kind of conservative Christian, but also aggressively nationalist United States. And then finally, in terms of resilience, of course, it has survived everything that the world has thrown at it and everything that it has inflicted upon itself since 1776, or if you prefer, after the creation of the modern union at the end of the 1780s. So it survived war with Britain in 1812, it survived the Civil War, it survived slavery, it prevailed in the two world wars, and of course in the Cold War, it overcame the legacy of Vietnam. So it has enormous resilience.
What I might just ask in first, Brendan, before we go to the PRC, is, what is the greatest threat to the United States' continued position as the world's premier great power? And does it come from within or does it come from without?
The greatest threat is the threat from within, the threat to the standing of the US in the world, which is a function of these internal turbulences, but also the threat actually of internal conflict. I don't mean necessarily civil war, but of internal paralysis to the extent that it becomes very, very difficult to operate in the world. I mean, we saw this a little bit with regard to Ukraine. That it seems now that has been overcome to a considerable extent, but it's certainly the case that the United States turned away or at least reduced its support for Ukraine in the straightforward military sense. It's still supporting it very strongly in terms of intelligence. But that decision was partly driven by a sense on the Republican side, on the MAGA side, that Ukraine was a Democrat project, a project of Biden, and they weren't going to go on with it. And you could think of other examples. So I think the internal threat is the greatest. The external threat would be being overtaken by the PRC in terms of economic performance and then perhaps in other respects as well.
Is the US under the Trump administration in danger of damaging that nexus that you spoke about earlier between reputation and resources?
So the nexus is very complicated because if you were talking earlier around about the question of how you mobilize allies. So take, for example, the relationship between the United States and its allies, where in many respects, the United States inherited, if you like, Britain's role as the main coordinator of, you know, European allies. So, you know, in the case of NATO, that's obvious that the United States not only had its own power, but was leading the NATO alliance. Now, if you are asking then about the nexus between resources and reputation with respect to Donald Trump, it's very hard to come to a view on this because he, on the one hand, has definitely damaged the reputation, damaged the brand. On the other hand, he has hugely increased the investment, that is to say, the resources. So where that then leaves the NATO share price is something really quite hard to establish. So if you are, say, a Russian planner sitting, opposite the Baltic states, you are now looking out on a NATO which is, in purely equipment terms, a great deal stronger than it was 4 years ago. There's no question about that. And a large part of that is down to Donald Trump's bullying, I'm sorry to say, that was necessary to achieve that. On the other hand, if you're a Russian planner, you are probably also asking, what is the relationship between those parts? Will they help each other? Will the Americans coordinate? That's more of a question mark. So it's hard to say whether the Russians are now more or less deterred. That's really quite a nice judgment.
I think that leads on nicely to the other certain great power in the book, and that is the People's Republic of China. Could you run us through the strengths and weaknesses of China as a great power?
So the PRC is the second largest economy in the world in nominal terms and probably close to the US if you take it in terms of purchasing power parity. So its economic resources are vast. It is increasingly also a very strong military power. So, for example, in the case of the PLA Navy, the Navy is actually larger than that of the US in terms of ships, I think not quite as large in terms of tonnage. And of course, you know, number of ships doesn't translate automatically into naval capacity, but it still is a very impressive navy and has long overtaken that of the UK, for example. The PRC has a growing nuclear arsenal. I'm not sure exactly how big it is now. It's north of 500 warheads. It had been about 350 for quite some time, and it is growing its nuclear arsenal, which is an interesting phenomenon because it feels, I think, a vulnerability there. When it comes to reach, the PRC is a bit more limited. It's got huge cultural, economic reach. It does have limitations in terms of its military reach. There's really only one external base, which is at Djibouti, but then in East Africa, but then, you know, lots of people have a base in Djibouti. There's nothing very special about that. And so the active military radius of the PRC is somewhat constrained, I think it's fair to say. Of course, it's got infrastructural reach with the great, you know, the Belt and Road initiative. So reach, I think, is more limited. In terms of reputation, the PRC very clearly stands for an alternative path of development, a modernization project which is not Western, which is not the United States. So in that sense, is a very identifiable presence in the world. And as far as resilience is concerned, that's the big imponderable. So you have a country which in the 19th century and the 20th century was for a very long time more of an object than a subject. And then, of course, as Mao says in 1949, China has stood up, it has sort of risen. And that's a big part of the appeal of the CCP, of the Chinese Communist Party, that it's vindicating, in a sense, Chinese nationalism, keeping foreigners out. And it's been effective in doing that. However, there have been moments, for example, at the time of Tiananmen Square in the summer of 1989, when the regime seemed on the verge of falling. And there have been other moments, for example, coming out of COVID, where again there's been widespread popular unrest. So just how stable the regime is something, just like in Russia, it is very hard to say, because with those kind of regimes, you don't see the cracks until they're very visible. So you don't have a long period of warning.
So that's the United States and China. Those two decisions that you've made in the book won't seem particularly controversial to most. I'd like to turn now to the other two selections that you've made, the tattered flags on the UK dust jacket, Britain and Russia. Russia might elicit some murmurs of discontent simply because what we've seen in Ukraine, where its forces have struggled and have in many ways been decimated by the conflict, and by the fact that Russia's economy appears to be tottering and at least in trouble. And finally, that it also has been forced to become more and more aligned with China and more subservient to China, some commentators would say. Why shouldn't we disqualify Russia as a great power just yet?
One of the points that I try to make in the book more generally is that we shouldn't become too fixated on specific moments in time, that we should look at the performance of powers over the longer period. So, for example, if we were having this conversation in 2021, I think there would be less of a question mark over Russia's great power status. There would be a great deal more respect for Russian arms, at that point, of course, largely untested in Europe itself, although there had already been an action in eastern Ukraine. If we were having that conversation in, say, the summer of 2022, we'd probably have a lower view of Russian power because of the immediate aftermath of the failed invasion. If we were having the conversation, let's say, at the start of 2025, with the arrival of the Trump administration and the military difficulties of Ukraine, we'd probably have a higher opinion of Russian abilities. So what I'm really getting at is that we shouldn't be too fixated on a particular moment. And I'm strongly of the view that even if Russia is in effect defeated or at least stalemated in Ukraine, and to be clear, the Ukrainian achievement has been, as you hint, has been absolutely stupendous. But even if Putin were to essentially cause a day now, which would be a kind of a strategic defeat, or even were to be forced to hand back a reasonable large amount of territory, Russia would still be a great power, given the size of its nuclear arsenal, which is the largest in the world, given the resilience of its economy, which after all has been under sanctions now, for very heavy sanctions for the last 4 years, Russia is still be a major actor.
And it certainly proved to be more resilient than many commentators thought it might be in, as you say, 2022 or 2023. In the case of Britain, there'll be many critics, many of whom come from Britain itself, who will say that the UK has hollowed out its state capacity for decades. The size of its armed forces are at an historic low. It's neglected its nuclear deterrent. And while all of this is going on, it's doing its best to give away its sovereignty over the strategic Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. Is this the behaviour of a great power, or is this the one of the sick men of Europe.
I've always found it very interesting that the criticism is focused more on the UK than Russia, because actually, in my view, the UK is ultimately a more important actor than Russia. It's certainly a large, much larger economy than Russia. Again, I come back to the point about looking at things over time. So the book was begun right really at the start of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, when the UK played a major role in supporting Ukraine and was widely regarded as having done so. And of course, it has come out from the point of view of the UK at almost exactly the wrong moment, which is the moment that you allude to, which is the fact that the UK has now fallen behind in relative terms compared to almost every other European state. So whereas for a very long period, so for decades, the UK was one of the top, sometimes the top spender in military terms in Europe, at least in democratic Europe. That's no longer the case. It is also the case that its overseas base structure is under challenge, and whether Chagos are actually going to be surrendered, of course, is in doubt. But they tried to, the government tried to essentially surrender them. I understand there's also a review concerning the sovereign base areas in Cyprus. So there is a general tendency in the current administration to devalue the overseas assets, which I think is a big mistake, because once lost, very hard to recover. So there are many reasons to be critical of the UK's position right now. But I'm optimistic for two reasons. First of all, because I think that the situation we're in now will not last. I think there will be a government which will come in and prioritize defense and the UK's position in the world, and will go to 3.5%. I think that's of GDP, of military spending. And I think it's only a matter of time before that happens. And when that does happen, that will then put the UK back in the position it was before these current controversies. But also because the fundamentals, I think, are sound. The UK has invested over time heavily in defense. It still has qualitatively one of the strongest armed forces. It plays a major role in the defense of the Baltic and the High North. It's a framework nation defending or deterring in Estonia. It leads the JEF, the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is a UK originated and UK led force, which is dedicated to the security of the Baltic, High North, and North Atlantic region. When Finland and Sweden made their application to join NATO, there was a period between the time they made the application and the kicking in of the Article 5 mutual security guarantee. So a moment of, if you like, of peril. And when that happened in the summer of 2022, they sought bilateral guarantees from the UK for their protection, which they were given. And of course, they would not have done that if they did not regard the UK as their major supporter. And lastly, if you come to Ukraine, the UK's support for Ukraine, certainly at the beginning, was the largest, the most effective of all the European states. It's now been overtaken in volume terms by Germany, but for a long time, the UK was leading. And Ukraine regards the UK really as its most important European sponsor. So when President Zelensky made his first foreign trip in person, of course, he'd had Zoom meetings, to Europe, or the rest of Europe, he came to London before he came to Brussels, which was a very clear sign that he regarded the UK as that important actor. So for all those reasons, while I acknowledge the difficulties, I'm still pretty confident that the UK is a great power.
If we move the frame of reference beyond Europe for a moment and we think about the UK's capacity in the Middle East or in the Indo-Pacific, does the UK have the ability to act in a way that is operationally, but also strategically, independent from the United States in these areas? Or will it always be America's deputy? And if it is America's deputy, can it also be a great power at the same time?
I would prefer to regard the relationship as symbiotic. So and that has been a big part of the effectiveness, in a sense, of the Anglo-American alliance. And of course, then, of the wider arrangements like Five Eyes, which is the intelligence collaboration between the two powers, but also including Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. So the UK is not in that sense a deputy. I mean, there have been very big differences over specific issues, for example, over Suez, over the invasion of Grenada by the United States, over Bosnia, and now latterly over the Gulf. So the UK does stand up for its own view when it has its own view as being different from the US. It's just that usually the view has been aligned for reasons of culture, of just seeing the world in a similar way. So while I understand the argument about the UK's dependency on the US, I don't see it in that way.
I'd like to turn now to Europe as a whole, and you pour a lot of cold water on the notion that the European Union is a great power, and you describe it as a geoeconomic power, but one built for a bygone era, one created in the aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Can you just explain to us why the European Union isn't a great power?
The European Union project, the European integration project, was really designed to be a post-great power project at one level. So in its origin, it had a project, it was really a plan for double containment to mobilize the continent against the Soviet Union, which was the imminent threat, but also to pacify the tensions within the continent, which of course had unloaded during the First and Second World Wars, so essentially a reconciliation between France and Germany, but also between other European powers. Now, that first function, mobilizing against the Soviet Union, which is a great power function, that function actually, after the failure of the European Defense Community project in the mid-1950s, which was turned down by the French, that function devolved to NATO. And so the second function, which was basically overcoming the tensions within Europe, that was something that the European Union has done very effectively, and that should not be minimized as an achievement. So I'm not knocking that. But that, of course, is not a great power project. In fact, it's the opposite. And that explains the very widespread sense in the European Union. You get it less now, but you certainly got it in the first 20 years or so after the fall of the Soviet Union, this belief in the European Union that actually they were beyond great power politics, that great power politics was no longer relevant, and the European Union had entered a new age, and therefore it didn't need to be a great power because there was no need of great powers.
Is the European Union and Europe more generally in danger of becoming one of the victims of this new age of great power competition if the European project doesn't transform itself into this great power overnight? Might it be fragmented along these geopolitical fault lines that are emerging? You know, are we likely to see a scramble for Europe in the coming years?
Yes. In fact, there are people who have written about this. Dimitar Becher, for example, speaks, I think, of the scramble for Europe. That's almost a sense that Europe has become the sort of 19th century Africa de nos jours, which I think is a little bit extreme. But it's certainly the case that Europe is vulnerable, shall we say, both to its own centrifugal forces, that the danger of fragmenting from within for various reasons, but also the danger of being crushed between the big actors, which would be Russia to the east, of course, the United States increasingly to the west, if you think of the Greenland incident as a good example of that, and of course the PRC, which is perhaps not a direct geopolitical competitor in the territorial sense, but is certainly an economic rival of quite considerable dimensions. And even the relationship between the United Kingdom and mainland Europe or the European Union post-Brexit has been conflictual from time to time. And so the European Union really needs to turn itself into a great power, a single state with those capacities. I've argued this for at least a decade, fruitlessly. Or it needs to be, in effect, a confederation of great powers. And then, you know, certainly Germany and France would have to become and act like great powers and collectively then deliver what Europe needs.
You wrote before for Engelsberg Ideas that Europe never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. What explains this indecision on becoming a great power, or transforming the European project. Why does Europe always seem to miss its turning point in history?
Of course, the concept of turning points, as historians, we know that that is also a kind of a judgment and a creating of a model, an expectation, because you might ask, well, why do you expect history to go this way or that way? But I, of course, you're quite right to remind me, I did say that, and I still believe it, that there have been moments along the way when Europe could have become a single power, and it refused to do so. So the obvious moment is immediately after the Second World War. Then you have the failure of the European Defence Community, which I mentioned earlier. Then you have the aftermath of the Cold War and the creation of the Euro. There was a moment then you could have embedded Germany in a wider European whole. You could have done it with the wars. At the time of the wars of Yugoslav succession, they could have been wars of European unity. It could have been at the time of the war on terror. It could have been the time of the global financial crisis. It could have been the time of the annexation of Crimea, and so on and so forth, right up to, of course, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And the reason why this hasn't happened is because Europe hasn't gone through the same process that the United Kingdom and the United States did. So it's really because the Europeans regard, and particularly the European institutions, regard European Union as a process rather than an event. Whereas in fact, the great unions have been created through events. You might work out the details at a later date, but you know, if you take the UK Union, that was achieved in 1706, 1707 in the context of the War of the Spanish Succession, where you had England and Scotland, albeit with the same monarch at one moment, and then you had a single state and a single parliament at the next moment. That was an event. Likewise with the United States, where it was all thrashed out at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and discussed, of course, in the Federalist Papers. The European Union has never approached the question really in this way. Of course, there have been moments, Maastricht Treaty, the Constitutional Convention, and so on. But these have always been seen as steps. There's never been a moment where the Europeans have sat down and said, we are threatened by the Russians, we are now threatened by Donald Trump, we are threatened economically by the Chinese. Now we need to create, now, at this moment, a single state. Nobody has ever really, or few people have ever really wanted to do that in Europe. And a big reason for that, apart from the in my view, the wrong intellectual framework, is because there has not been seen to be the necessity, because the Europeans were always protected by outsiders, by the British, but of course, particularly by the Americans.
And so much of the model, if I could put it that way, that takes place in Europe over whether it could become a great power project, mm-hmm. is shaped by two of the other nearly great powers that you look at in the book. Mm-hmm. And those are France and Germany. Can you explain why, in some ways, the European project constrains their ability to become great powers? Because I think that will strike some readers as a counterintuitive point in the book. The European Union is supposed to enhance the power of its member states in the world, but you say that it can also act as a drag on their ability to be considered as great powers.
Well, in the case of Germany, the connection is very, very clear. Germany, in a sense, uploads its great powerness to the European Union. It, in a sense, it hides within the European Union. So it expects the European Union and, of course, NATO to do those things which it does not want to do itself as Germany. And that's, of course, to do with the history of the Second World War, the history of the Holocaust, the mass murder of the German Jews, the terrible things that Germany did during the 12 years of the Third Reich. That is such a brutal historical legacy that it has shaped Germany's view of its role in the world. And so it doesn't want to act as a great power, and therefore Europe becomes the excuse for not doing so. And so, but Europe in turn, of course, does not act, or at least does not act effectively in that way. So what we see is a phenomenon of powers, in a sense, being surrendered upwards to the European Union, but then rather being maximized at the center, which is what happens with the UK and the US unions and then being used for good or for ill, in a sense, a lot of the power simply evaporates. So that in many respects, the European Union in the geopolitical sense is less than the sum of its parts. Now, if we come to France, the situation is less clear-cut. And the French will argue passionately, and President Macron is one of those who's done so most loudly of all, that actually the European Union supercharges France, increases French power, and that the European sovereignty is then the defense of French sovereignty. And I think there is something in that, but it is also the case that in many very important respects, France no longer exists as a state. It doesn't have its own currency and would find it very difficult to return to the franc. It doesn't control its own borders, except in an emergency situation, and is in many other ways constrained as well as supercharged by the European Union. So again, France, in that sense, is limited as an actor.
We're going to pivot to Asia now, and we're going to look at India, because I think that is also another feature of the book that some commentators might find issue with. Why did you decide that India is not a great power? It hasn't ascended to that level yet.
I think there are really two reasons for that. One is that India is internally fragmented. It suffers heavily from backwardness, despite its economic gains in recent times. It has severe sectional controversies, often quite bloody ones. There's also a sense within India that actually being a great power is not actually something that India should be. I mean, there are differences around that, but there's, you know, historically, the Indians have not claimed to be a great power in the conventional sense. They see themselves more as an exemplar within the world. And so that's important. They don't see themselves as interfering outside of their own immediate neighborhood, where they do act you know, as if they had a sphere of influence in places like Bhutan, for example, or Nepal. But also there are quite significant constraints on India's reach and its resources. So, you know, it has an important navy for the Indian Ocean, but it doesn't have a global reach. I think that's fair to say. And it has done quite badly in conflicts against the PRC and actually laterally also against Pakistan.
I think that touches on another thread that runs through this book, and that is the importance of history when it comes to great power status, and the sense that history can be considered in two senses, not only as the events of the past, but also historical memory, that is the narratives that great powers tell themselves. And this has particular relevance, it seems, not only for India, but also for Germany and Japan. Can you explain why, in the case of Japan, history is the main constraint?
So like Germany, Japan had a traumatic experience in the Second World War. And like Germany, of course, it also inflicted severe pain on much of Asia, particularly China and Korea. It also inflicted severe pain other parts of the region, in Philippines and in Indonesia. But the legacy there is a little bit more complicated, because in some ways, Japan was also seen as the agent of decolonization, which it certainly wasn't in China and Korea. And as a result of that, Japan was given a constitution, which by Article 9 limits its military activities. It doesn't have armed services as such. It has self-defense forces. It has aircraft carriers in all but name, but they're not called aircraft carriers because that might seem aggressive. They have some other appellation. So you have in Japan a whole mindset that has developed since 1945, which is in many quarters deeply hostile towards the idea of great powerness. You also, of course, have elements within Japan which would like the country to play an important role again in the world, and more to the point, feel that unless Japan is prepared, will be unable then to deter the PRC in particular, but also North Korea, which threatens it on a regular basis with rocket exercises, and also Russia, with which it now has a bad relationship on account of the Northern Isles, which of course were annexed by Russia at the end of the Second World War. So things are changing in Japan, but history in Japan, Germany is basically a constraint rather than being a driver as it is in other countries.
Towards the end of the book, you map out a number of potential scenarios in terms of where our age of great power rivalry might be heading. And one of those scenarios is a great power conflict, led on the one hand by the United States and the Western world order, and on the other side, the crinks, so China, North Korea, Russia, and Iran. Where might this kind of conflict break out? What is the scenario in which there is a cascade to this catastrophic war?
It's very hard to tell, but my instinct, and here I'm simply following, you know, the advice of the real experts on East Asia, my instinct is that a war over Taiwan seems less likely than because the relationship over Taiwan is highly ritualized. So, for example, during the 50s, you know, there are Taiwanese islands just off the mainland. And, you know, the PLA and the Taiwanese armed forces used to shell each other on alternate days. You know, it was that formalized. And so while there had been crises around PRC exercises, around visits from Nancy Pelosi and so on, and indeed there have been really quite hairy moments. Actually, the biggest incident was actually 30 years ago in 1996. Many people say that seems the most dangerous moment, but we've had more recent ones. But nevertheless, I think both the PRC, Taipei, the capital of Taiwan, and the Americans have got a fairly clear idea of what can be done and what can't be done. So I think unless Taiwan were to declare independence, which I think would be a provocation, a very serious provocation to the PRC, and I would not advise them doing, I think absent that, it seems unlikely there will be an escalation over Taiwan, not least because any attack the PRC might launch would have to, the planners on the PRC side would have to assume that all the other forces in the region, particularly the Americans, but also South Koreans and especially the Japanese, were hostile. So unless they were certain they were not hostile, they would have to attack them simultaneously. And then we would be in a world war. By contrast, if you look at the South China Sea, that is a crisis of more recent provenance. And you've got now daily encounters in, you know, places like Scarborough Shoal between the Philippines and the PRC. And there the waters are much less charted, and nobody's really sure who will back whom and what the escalation ladder is, as the jargon goes. And so my concern is that you could see an escalation in the South China Sea, which would then ratchet up and then suck in everybody in a sort of 1914 style scenario.
How would that scenario play out? How would a new global conflict, a World War III between the great powers, play out in your view?
Obviously, a great deal depends on whether that conflict became nuclear or not. What we've seen more recently with the case of Ukraine is that actually, although nuclear threats have been issued on the Russian side, nuclear weapons have not been used. And indeed, the Russian Federation did not use nuclear weapons, even when it was attacked within metropolitan Russia in the case of the Ukrainian incursion into Kursk. So obviously, if there was a nuclear exchange, then we would all be killed and that would be the end of it. If, on the other hand, the conflict was confined to a conventional exchange, my assumption is that that would end very badly for the PRC and the Russian Federation, simply because the way the strategic geography works, they would likely be cut off from the rest of the world and likely would in the end be strangled economically, just as it was the case in the First and Second World War and to a certain extent during the Cold War as well. But that of course, is not a certainty. That is simply my answer to your question.
There is also perhaps a more hopeful note, and that is that we might learn from history. And you suggest in particular that we learn from the origins of the Second World War and Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan's decision to wage war against the Allies. What are the lessons you take from that other great global conflict?
Well, I think certainly as far as Japan was concerned, I think Imperial Japan felt by the end of 1941 that it was boxed into a corner. And whatever its crimes, and they were many, and whatever its aggressions, and these were numerous, as the 7th of December approached, what it was thinking about primarily was the oil embargo, the scrap metal embargo on the American side, which would basically set the clock ticking, and they felt themselves pushed into a corner. And so I think we in the West, I can only speak now from my own rootedness as a Westerner and as a sympathizer with the Western cause, a supporter of Taiwan, a supporter of Ukraine, and so on and so forth. I think that we need, on the one hand, to be robust and to defend our interests, and that means supporting Taiwan and Ukraine, but equally not to provoke the enemy. So not to encourage Taiwan to declare independence, not to seek to intervene militarily directly within Russia in a way that suggests that we are trying militarily to achieve regime change as the West. Of course, it's legitimate for Ukraine to attack the aggressor, but I think we as the West would be well advised to step back from that. So if that is achievable, and if in turn the Russian Federation and the PRC themselves learn from the lessons of history, and we know that the Chinese leadership has studied history very, very closely indeed, and perfectly understands its relative weakness in the world. If that can be done, then I think we will get through this without war, major war.
I think it's clear in your conclusion as well that so much of what happens next in global politics depends on which vision of foreign policy wins out in Washington and which version of America decides to express itself on the global stage. Can you just take us through the competing visions that are currently warring in Washington and which one you think is most likely to lead the United States foreign policy in the future?
To take your last question first, I'm assuming that a Democrat will win at the next election in 2028. That's not a given, but I'm assuming for various reasons to do with the difficulties of the Trump administration, that would be the case. But, of course, that's by no means a certainty. So there are many, many different shades of possibilities of what might happen. So we could persist with the current approach, which actually I think is less deleterious to Ukraine than many people make out. So, for instance, the intelligence support to Ukraine is stronger than it was under Biden. And now we have even the talk that Ukraine will be given permission to manufacture Patriots under license. Ukraine has been given greater permission to launch deep strike into Russia, which was not the case previously. So even if you had a persistence of the current system, I think in Europe that might be less worrisome than some people think. On the other hand, if you had a more interventionist Republican administration or a classically Biden-esque Democrat administration, you would see probably a ramping up even of that support. So a return to full-scale U.S. military support on top of what the Europeans are now paying for, which I think would make a substantial difference in Europe. But you can also envisage a democratic leadership which might trend more to the AOC or Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, which might conceivably retreat even further from the world in some ways than the Trump administration, because the Trump administration hasn't really retreated. It has rebalanced, but it has been in many respects hyperactive. But if you had a Sanders-style administration, you could see them massively reducing its role in the Middle East. You could see them giving up on Taiwan. You could see them winding down in Europe. That, from my Western point of view, would be very undesirable. So there are many, many different different possibilities as regards the administration. And then, of course, a lot will depend on what happens in Congress, because there are many things a president can propose, but on other things, Congress disposes. You know, it decides over monetary allocations. It's got to approve military action after a certain period of time, and so on. So we shall see.
The return of the great powers ends on a slightly pessimistic note. The great powers are back, and their rivalry is likely to scupper cooperation on all of these important transnational issues, whether that's climate change or nuclear non-proliferation. If we are looking for a more optimistic scenario, is there any situation that you foresee where a sudden, unexpected event, a bit like the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union, for example, suddenly changes the geopolitical calculus, and that there isn't necessarily a transformation back into the world we knew right at the end of the Cold War, but at least there is a kind of détente in this great power rivalry, and it creates the space and the environment in which great powers can cooperate more closely on these issues again?
Well, that kind of relationship is always possible, even where you have different systems. And so the PRC, for example, at least argues that it is a major partner on climate change. And of course, it's complicated because it has all these coal-fired power stations. It is itself a major polluter, but at the same time, it is also pushing ahead with the green transformation, with electric vehicles and so on. So you could see a situation where the great powers do collaborate on climate. But as I say in the book, and as we see today at the moment, it's so inflected now with great power concerns around PRC domination of the green energy sector, the need for energy security and so on and so forth. The other way in which this could happen, of course, is through major democratic positive transformation in Russia and in the PRC, which doesn't seem likely at the moment, but is not impossible. And of course, is not something that you can really predict. These kind of developments always seem impossible beforehand, and then they seem inevitable in retrospect. But it's, you know, nobody predicted the fall of the communist system in 1989 through to 1991. So it is perfectly possible that something similar would happen in the PRC and Russia in the near or perhaps not too distant future. And that in turn would create a whole raft of new possibilities.
A note to historians to be humble about the predictions that they make. Brendan, thank you so much for taking the time to take us through this fascinating new book. It's available in all reputable booksellers. And thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.